Speaking of disconnected domains, I'm a little bit of a disconnected point in this talk on semi-classical analysis, because I'm going to do classical analysis of a certain way. So forget the semi. And what I'm going to talk about is invariant tori for Hamiltonian systems. And I think my point is mostly to talk about the last several years' work on invariant tori for PDE, which is infinite dimensional phase space problems. But in fact, if Harold Donnelly doesn't mind, I'm going to also repeat just a piece of a conversation I had with him in February, because it has something in there to do with this. So let me tell you what a Hamiltonian system looks like. And by the way, it's warm outside, and I'm just going to give a gentle talk. I'm not going to go into too many technical details. And I have no slides. So let me, except this chalk is really insubstantial. Let me just talk in generalities. Here is an equation 1. So I want to talk about d by dt of v is equal to a vector field, and then I want to look at the flow of that vector field. And my vector field is going to be in the following form, j, the gradient, I'm going to write the gradient this way, du dj, gradient u, of a function h of u, where, well, for general purpose, I want u to be in some space, and I'm going to make that a Hilbert space, maybe, or a Hilbert manifold, or maybe some finite dimensional neighborhood of a point in Rn. But let's just think Hilbert space to keep our mind open. And I want it to be Hamiltonian, so I've sort of set it up to be that way. So I want there to be a symplectic form. So if I have two tangent vectors to that Hilbert space, I can identify the Hilbert space with its tangent space at every point. And then I just need to write this. I guess I can represent this in terms of the Hilbert space inner product. I'm having trouble with the chalk in this damp weather. And the J will obey some rules. Sorry? Big chalk. I hate the big chalk. Maybe if I break too much, I'll be forced to go to the big chalk. Where J obeys some rules, and in particular, it has to be Q symmetric, and maybe some other things. And then we have a flow. And that's going to be phi T starting at some point V. And that's going to be, say, V of T, where V of 0 is equal to that, maybe call this starting point V naught. So I have V naught, and then I flow by V of T.
Omega is a complex pronoun or
a real number? Omega, I'm sorry, is a two-form. And X and Y, and this is going to be a real Hilbert space, and X and Y are going to be real vectors. And everything has a sub R. I'll put one sub R and then I'll stop. And occasionally things will turn complex, but it's potentially infinite dimensional, it's potentially four dimensional, it's potentially two dimensional. So what I want to tell you is maybe I'll give an index to my talk just as an organizing principle. I'm going to give examples. I'm going to give examples of ODE and PDE. Then I want to, give at least a formal vision of a variational principle from which one may find invariant tori. So I want invariant tori. For one, I have to tell you why I want tori which are invariant under something. I mean, I have to explain that. But I want to say invariant tori as a variational principle. Three, I guess I should give a long list of results and who proved them, but maybe I'll make that four so we can just, you can turn your mind off by then. If you want to claim priority, you can make your claims at that point. And maybe I'm going to put in three. I'm going to say something about how you actually apply this, and what's important when there are resonant tori is that it's a combination of classical analysis. I mean, you have to make some perturbation scheme converge, but also you want to count solutions, multiplicity of solutions, and that involves a Morse-Bott type of theory. So a Morse-Bott theory, or a little tiny piece of one, and then I'll say results. And if we're lucky, we won't have to do too many of the results, and we just can relax on the rest of the job. So let's start, if you don't mind me starting on an elementary level, I mean, I already did, but let's just take principal examples. That's the best thing. So section one is principal examples. So why don't we take Z equals X, Y, this is my example one. In R2, well, maybe 2N to make it slightly better. And then H is going to be a real-valued function on R2N. I'm having trouble with this chalk. It is a moist day. With certain smoothness, let's just say it's C infinity. And I'm interested in looking near, so look near Z equals 0. So we're only in neighborhoods of R2N. And there, I can certainly well have, as long as omega is non-degenerate, I certainly can write omega in the following way. Dyj wedge dxj sum over j. Another neat way to write that is half dz j dz. And in fact, it turns out to be d of something, which is y dx, if I get the signs right. And then if I'm given such an H, then my Hamiltonian system, if I write that down, is going to be x dot, of course, is equal to partial y of h, and y dot is equal to minus partial x of h, as everyone knows. And you could say, I have some arbitrary omega, but at least near zero, I use Darboux's theorem, or you might call these Darboux coordinates. Okay, my example two, or really it's example one continued. Oh, and I also, while I'm doing this, just give examples of such things. So how about if I have H, or maybe a standard example, so it's going to be my H0, it's going to be the following thing. Sum J equals 1 to N, because I'm in N dimensions, 1 half YJ squared, YJ squared, plus omega J squared over 2, XJ squared, the harmonic oscillator. Why not? And example 2, which is example 1, again, which is, why don't I rewrite this and just secretly make it complex? So I write X plus IY, now it's in Cn, which is R2n. And then I write omega as imaginary part of dzj wedge dzj bar, or maybe I have trouble with the sign, but forgive me for that. Maybe it's minus that. Maybe there's a half. Then my differential equation, which I've just written here, I can rewrite as dz by dt is equal to I, the z bar gradient of h, which now is a function of z and z bar, so to speak. And I can rewrite, if I want, my Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillator as a sum by slight changes of variables, symplectic changes of variables, actually, zj squared. So these x's might not quite be those x's, but close. And sum j up to n. And you might say this is not quite a canonical transformation because j is not quite the same thing, but these are symplectic. complex coordinates. And you might say, well, how about d by dz bar? Well, of course, that's redundant. You just take the bar of the equation, but of course, might as well write it. D by dt is z bar is equal to minus I the z derivative of h. And forgive me for being terribly elementary, but how about number three, which is, I'll rewrite it again, which is, this. So from here to here is essentially a canonical transformation, modulo a few i's between friends. And let's do another canonical transformation in our heads, which is, how about if I take I and then c, an angle, so actions and angles in, how about r plus n dimensions cross an n torus. And then symplectic form will be, if I get the sign right, which way did I decide the sign was going to be? Dij wedge dcj, if I'm lucky. And then if I write, and then, my harmonic oscillator turns out to be a sum of omega jij, j equals 1 to n, And if I now just write down what the equations of motion should be, it's I dot, so d by dt of ij, is equal to the cj derivative of h0, which is, of course, 0. And cj dot, oh, this is probably a minus, because then cj dot is plus ij derivative of h0, which turns out to be omega j. And this we can solve in our sleep. My daughter, I guess, can solve it. I explain it to her, right? Speaking about the last talk, I think children can solve it, which is I better not move. If they understand the definition, I think was the statement in the last talk. I is ij 0, and then cj of t, of course, moves at frequency omega j. So it's cj of 0 plus t omega j. And, of course, those are all the harmonic oscillator, and this is a way you can prove in 3 minutes in your first graduate course on this how you solve harmonic oscillator and action angle variables. What can I say? Anyway, these are action angle variables. I did the whole thing so I could write action angle variables. Well, I should really give you examples in PDE. So let me go, this is example 1, 2, and 3, but really it's example 1. I guess I'll call example 2 number 4 because of my numbering. So how about if I take a wave equation? And it'll be a nonlinear equation to make it interesting. So if I take a function u, dt squared, u is equal to dx squared. How about if I make it multidimensional, Laplacian u, minus a function g of x and u. And now x will lie in some domain in R d, for example. And complicated questions on the behavior of multiples, n-tuples of spectra come into this problem. And those are hard in general for a general domain. So, in fact, most of the time, my omega is going to be a d torus. Well, let me say it could be a non-standard d torus. So let me make this r d mod some gamma. And gamma might vary. But in any case, generally a d torus. One usually can handle a d torus. And then you put boundary conditions on this. I mean, a general domain might be Dirichlet. For a d torus, I might make it a manifold or, say, periodic boundary conditions. For the function u. And then if I... But I want to make that look like a Hamiltonian system. So let me say the following thing. I'm going to introduce a new function p, and I'm going to write a Hamiltonian. H is going to be the integral over that domain of half p squared plus 1/2 grad u squared plus some nonlinear function capital G might depend on x and u, or maybe more things, dx. And then I can write this PDE. I have equation 1 up there, so this is going to be my equation 2. I write equation 2 as the following. The P dot, which is d by dt of P, but I'm going to make it indulge myself and write it a partial derivative because it's a partial differential equation, is going to be equal to, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. U dot is equal to P, which is equal to the P variation of H, the P gradient of H, gradient with respect to the L2 norm, and then the d by dt of P has got to be equal to minus the gradient with respect to U of H, and we can work that out to be Laplacian U minus the U derivative of gradient G. So as long as I manage to write G as the U derivative of a big capital G, which is always the case if U is a scalar, was always possible if U is a scalar, then I have written 2 in a Hamiltonian way, where in fact the symplectic form between, say, two vector fields is given by integral of x, j, y, dx over the domain. So it's really just notational, but it's something I want to do. Now let me continue this example for a little bit to just to make the setting sink in. I'll leave this message on the board for still a few minutes. So let's suppose that g of x and u has the following form. It might be one. Let's take a. I mean, I haven't said anything about h. I mean, g at zero could be some function. Zero need not be an equilibrium. So let's, because it's PDE, it's nice to have something that stands still for a moment at least. Let's make zero and u equals zero a solution of the equation at least. So I'm going to start g as Taylor expansion in u up starting at quadratic term. So I might have a coefficient, say g1 of x, u squared, plus another coefficient, say g2 of x, u cubed, plus maybe more coefficients. And if I plug that into h, which has g in it, so that means that h itself, a function of u and p, will have an h, a quadratic term, plus h, a cubic term, plus etc. And this will be have the property that the variation of h about 0 is equal to 0 because there are no linear terms. The constant terms don't matter because you differentiate it to find the Hamiltonian vector field. And what's important then to study the motion at least near 0 is to at least, I mean, most people think it's important at least for a short time, is to understand the behavior of the H2. So what is H2? So H2, the homogeneous degree 2 part of G, will read off partly from this blackboard. So it's going to be integral over the domain, half p squared plus half grad u squared, and g is only going to contribute this term. So one, that's why I put the half in, so it looks kind of nice, g1 u squared dx plus, well, plus nothing, because I'm truncating the Hamiltonian to quadratic term. That's the way you linearize the problem around zero. And then I'm interested in studying the behavior of h. Well, it turns out that if I study the following auxiliary problem, if I studied a linear operator, which will depend on the coefficient g1, on eigenfunctions e1 of x, and that linear operator's definition is minus Laplacian plus g1 of x times e1, and I want to study the spectral problem, so that's omega squared e1, I want e, sorry, e. Omega squared e of x, and I study this problem with e of x equal to, for x in the boundary of my domain, E of x equaling the boundary, doing what the boundary conditions dictate, i.e. periodic or Dirichlet, then this gives me a, at least for domains I want to continue, at least for my torus, or at least for compact domains, it gives me a sequence of eigenfunctions, ej of x, and eigenvalues, omega j squared, with which I can actually express H2 in a nice form. And if I do that, I'll come up with the following generalized Fourier series for the functions P and U. That will be sum over K, 1 half PK squared plus omega K squared over 2 UK squared sum over K. K equals 1 to infinity. I guess I should call this J because I just labeled it J. Maybe it's easier to replace this label by K. And this is a complete set of K equals 1 to infinity. And of course, we recognize this is my example 1, and this is in Darboux coordinates. So this is Darboux, and this is a harmonic oscillator. So I'm sorry to bore you, but what I want to do is still one more elementary step for reasons of elucidation, that I want to solve this equation, this linear equation for the linear wave equation by separation of variables. So my apologies again. So we have a harmonic oscillator with frequencies omega k. Now the frequencies happen to be infinite. Nobody's complained that the omega k squareds could be negative. They possibly are. It's just notation. But most of them are positive. A few may be negative. So let's solve this. Solution of a linear equation. So now, this is my equation 3. I'm solving partial t of the vector up is equal to j, the gradient, so it's the gradient of u and then the gradient p. It has two function space components, but of h2 alone. So that's a linear equation in u and p. And the spectrum of this operator, of course, is of interest. So I can solve this explicitly, if you forgive me for doing this. U of t, p of t is equal to sum over k, e k of x, those are the eigenfunctions, times cosine t omega k plus c k, cosine t omega k plus c k, sine t omega k plus c k, and if I do this right, I'll get it normalized right, and then minus omega k sine t omega k plus ck. Starting, this whole thing applies to my initial uk0, pk0. What do we conclude? One, then you can separate variables and solve PDE, probably the most miserable way to teach PDE to undergraduates. But you also conclude that every orbit, let's exclude the one where omega squared is negative. Only, let's pretend only omega squared is positive. Every orbit is the, so the statement is every orbit is, so every solution is, one, it could be periodic. For example, let's set all these initial data points to zero except for one pair, or one. Then it has period 2 pi over omega k. Or quasi-periodic. If maybe several are active, the rest are zero, and they all happen to have a finite, well, and then you take the frequencies and they happen to be, have certain higher than one dimension as considered over the rationals. But of course, if you make infinitely many coefficients active and you look for general coefficients, it may well be that you don't get finite many frequency Hill, but infinite frequency Hill, and then you have an almost periodic. But that's all solutions. And so it motivates a question. What happens if I don't just do H2, but if I do actually the full nonlinear PDE? Are there some places in our phase space, of that Hilbert space there, on which this kind of motion persists? That's the idea. Let me state a few facts as this goes along, because it helps elucidate things. The Hamiltonian, of course, H2, let's call this flow, this is some complicated matrix, let's call this flow capital Phi of T, operating on U naught, P naught. So it's the flow of the linear equation. It's capital letters for linearized equation, small letters for nonlinear equations. Maybe I should have reversed it, but sorry about that. So the Hamiltonian on the flow of a starting point Z is preserved as long as I'm allowed to solve the equation. That's standard. It's a harmonic oscillator, so actions are preserved, which is if I form the following things. I look at 1/2 omega k uk, let me make this a clearer u, uk squared plus 1 upon omega k pk squared, and I call that ik of z of t, if these are my solution at time t, then this is ik at zero. Its actions are preserved. Of course, the angles, you can see the angles evolving like this. Ck under time evolution goes to Ck plus T omega K. So it behaves as it should be. Okay. Questions. So questions. What you'd like to see is whether some or many or all of the solutions, So I think these are basic questions. Of course, they've been around they've had answers since the 60s for Hamiltonian, finite dimensional Hamiltonian dynamical systems, but I think this is a good direction to look in infinite dimensional phase spaces. So basic questions are, one, whether some periodic or quasi-periodic or almost periodic solutions exist for PDE. And not even maybe start looking at the measure in phase space of which those take, because that starts bringing up difficult questions and what, with respect to what measure on your Hilbert space, if any. So this is really in the realm of KAM theory. How about another question? Well, one, if it is a PDE, suppose I start with my data V-naught, I guess U-naught I called it. I take the call if my U-naught is in phase space. Suppose U-naught is in the ball of radius R about zero in phase space. Then can I flow U-naught? I mean, even if it's a PDE, does this exist? Well, that's a classical question in PDE, which the answer is sometimes, study a lot, read lots of papers. Some equations are easier than others. But you might also ask, does U of T remain in a ball, say, radius twice R for all T? That's like a stability question, like a well Posner's question. Or you might say, if I take U-naught and I take the kth action of U-naught and I look at it, what happens, and I look at it at time t, and then I look at the kth action of my initial data and look at the size of this. Can you make this smaller than something? For example, can you make this less than epsilon to the alpha for t less than t of epsilon, which usually grows quite large in epsilon. These things are typically e to the 1 over epsilon to the beta, and then people worry about which alpha and which beta. Now, this is like a Nikorov-Shov stability question. And we'd like to ask those about PDE. And then the third question is, I'm not going to wax too long on this because there are not really that many results, which is, question 2 is an upper bound on the growth of solutions. In fact, the clever thing that you learn from mechanics is don't try to control the angles because they will diverge linearly in time, but try to control the actions, which are well controlled for exceedingly long periods of time. And this is an upper bound, which occurs in non-degenerate situations, but you might try lower bounds, which grow. Can you find lower bounds which grow? And that will go under two things. The harder one is basically a question of Arnold diffusion. Let me say the following, that if I just put it in this generality, this is a harder problem for PDE than ODE, and this is a harder problem for PDE than ODE, but in fact this is an easier problem for PDE than ODE, because it's easier to diffuse if you have more dimensions than you have less. There's more room to move around. Nonetheless, there's not very many results. So I want to insert something just a little bit different and finite dimensional on you, which is why KAM theory might be interesting to people who are not just interested in the behavior of near-integrable Hamiltonian systems. And this dates, so I just want to repeat the results of a conversation of mine with Donnelly in February. And I hope he doesn't mind if I repeat this in public. Which is, so the question is, KAM interesting? So his question to me was about, well, essentially about flow on spheres. Actually, probably who would say a geodesic flow. So G flow on spheres. So let's do the following thing. My statement one is this. I take a sphere. I guess spheres have equators. And I look at simply a two-sphere with the standard metric. And of course, the geodesic flow takes place on the I'd like to be Hamiltonian, so I'm going to put it on the cotangent bundle. And on the round sphere, all geodesics are round. All geodesics are great circles. So one question you could ask is, can you take G naught? Can you take a metric G, which is equal to G naught, plus a small perturbation, and to make ergodic flow? That's not quite what he asked me. And of course, so let me just illustrate by making, here's the round sphere, but you make something that has a bump in it, so to speak. Let me tell you something a little bit closer to what he said to me. How about if you don't consider, this is his actual question, so actual. Let's take a surface of revolution. So I don't know, I'll make it sort of pear-shaped. Well, it's fair rendition, not quite right. And it has maybe a waist. And then there, so this is some surface, M2. With the just with the metric that's given by the blackboard metric given by the embedding that I've endowed it with, and it turns out to be a geodesic flow. So G flow is integrable. It's because it's a surface of revolution. So there's the Hamiltonian, which is the energy of the geodesic flow, and there's also what's called the Clairaut integral. So then the form of the question is as follows, is you take G naught, this is G naught for this, and you add delta G, so G naught, let's make it smooth. I agree that he was not going to make it smooth, or he was going to try to not do this theorem by not making it smooth. I'm going to make it smooth, so that's my answer to him. And I'm going to add a smooth perturbation, and I call that G, and it's not going to be a perturbation which is a perturbation of revolution. It's going to be another bump, which does not respect that. And the question is, can you find delta G to make the flow? So is the G flow, too many G's, but geodesic flow, ergodic? And I'm going to answer no. If under conditions on G naught and under conditions on a few conditions on G naught and a little condition on delta G, but smoothness, if smooth plus something. And then just to say why this is not a ridiculous thing to do, well, there are not so many sources there are famous sources, but we can't count too many sources of really well-known and well-studied ergodic flow. One of them also comes from Stanford, and I think he was also a student in my real analysis class, Victor Donnet. So there's Victor Donnet's example. Which looks a bit like a hyperbolic surface, like this. And these should be cusps, and you cut them. And on there, the curvature is negative. In fact, it's constant negative, if you wish. And things are very strongly hyperbolic. And then he figures out how to make caps on these and fit them on smoothly. So those are positive curvature regions, so there's focusing rather than defocusing, but not enough to save the flow. And so geodesic flow here is ergodic. In any case, it's topologically a sphere, as I hope people can see. And good. So that's where it's ergodic and more. I believe it's, in fact, anosov, although all the experts in the audience can correct me. So let me say something about example two. So I can turn my damp pages. It's Bernoulli. Bernoulli is great. Anosov says something about smoothness and probably about something about the mapping that makes Bernoulli. Bernoulli's maybe. Yeah, Anosov probably says something about the mapping to a Bernoulli flow. But anyway, let's see if I can state a theorem. And that's about case two. So for typical G naught, that means for typical pairs, you know, for typical surfaces of revolution, in case two, typical is going to be smooth, C infinity or C finite, but C infinity will do. With the perturbation also sufficiently smooth, C infinity will do. The geodesic flow is not ergodic. And here's the proof. And the proof is there exist KM tori. So I have to explain that. There exist KM tori. So I said there are some conditions. So the two conditions are as follows. Whoops, this is diagram is out of my reach, so I can't point out it so well. Victor Donnet's example is going to be erased, so I can rewrite the pair without moving the board. So here's the pair. being a surface, so this is G naught. This is M2 G naught. The maximum point here is a periodic orbit. And it's an elliptic periodic orbit. So that's someplace around which one can perturb. So this is an elliptic periodic orbit. You can perturb around that. And so typical means when you look at tori near, when you look at near that point, there are going to be tori which satisfy, so to speak, the Arnold condition. That is, the frequency changes with action. So for typical G naught, that will occur near this point. So my hypotheses are non-degeneracy near the waist of this MG0. And then my other non-degeneracy condition is going to be, well, I can't put in delta G, which is a surface of revolution, which is a perturbation of revolution, clearly, because I still have the Clairol interval. So I have to have something which is non-surface of revolution, but also, I guess I need it sufficiently smooth. But almost any, if I violate those two things, almost any small, sufficiently smooth thing will do. So delta G naught, not, how do you say it, not of revolution, small, smooth. Those are the hypotheses. Then, well, let me give you the proof. Not only that, let me give you two proofs. So proof one. It goes as follows. Do KAM theory near this point, near this orbit. So KAM implies positive measure of invariant tori. So positive measure means the rest can't have full measure. So no way to get it. You got it. Classic argument. Proof number two. A KEM torus, let's count dimensions. So this says you have to find a family of KEM tori, and the standard construction techniques allow you to make it a positive measure. But let's suppose we have one KEM torus. Well, let's just count dimensions. One KEM torus does the following. Let's count dimensions. Well, the geodesic flow, as I've posed it, is something in the cotangent space, but in fact, the energy is preserved, the Hamiltonian is preserved, so in fact, it sits in the cotangent space of amplitude r, minus its scale, so it could be 1, but anyway, that's the integral. So the flow preserves this set, which is three-dimensional, and of course, T star M2. And then inside this is a KEM torus, which is two-dimensional. So it divides this into two bits. And those are two components which can't mix by the flow if the torus is invariant. Invariant. So that's proof number two. Let me stop doing finite-dimensional things. I just thought I'd mention that because Harold is here. So let me now finish the remainder three-quarter of hour of my talk and next 15 minutes. What I'm going to do is just give you several further examples. I have to cut the contents a little bit. I'm going to give you several examples and then try to say a little bit about the interesting variational problem which comes up. Okay? So my example 1, 2, 3, 4, I guess I'm on 5, which is the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, NLS. So I partial T U minus half Laplacian U plus some nonlinear function of Q of X depends on U, also can depend on U bar, is equal to 0. And let's just not fool around. Really, only things that people can handle are d-dimensional X modulo some lattice torus with periodic boundary conditions. This is a D torus, periodic boundary conditions are implied. And we can write this in terms of a Hamiltonian, which is integral of that torus, half grad U squared. So now U is complex. U has values in the complex. plus some capital G of X U bar, where I want the Hamiltonian to be real, so I need G of X, Z, and W to be in the reals whenever W is equal to Z bar. And I want it to be also, to say anything about it analytically, I want it to be sufficiently smooth. Say analytic is, avoids all issues. And then and G's relation to Q is, of course, I want to take the U bar derivative of G, and that's the way I get Q. And if you find Q by some other method and it's not the U bar derivative of G, it's very hard to justify yourself doing quantum mechanics, which it sits here. It needn't be phase, needn't have the phase symmetry, as I've indicated, but you at least should have this. And then, of course, this system, I mean, this equation, my equation 5, can be expressed as follows. Partial T U equals I, the U bar variation of H. And so J is, of course, I times the identity. This is complex symplectic coordinates. I want to give two more examples because examples are nice. So I'd like to give this is now 6, it's the standard KDV example. So something of the following form, a time derivative of a function Q. Q is real valued. And I'm going to have X in the circle. This only really makes sense if X is one dimensional. Is equal to 1/6 dx cubed q minus the x derivative of the q derivative of some capital G of x and q. Then this is a Hamiltonian H integral over my circle, 1/12 dx q squared plus capital G x q. Dx, and J is equal to partial X. Maybe it's minus partial X. And if you look at Q dot is equal to J, the variation with respect to Q of H, that's equal to that equation. And why my indulgence with the 1/6 and then 1/12? Well, if you do surface water waves, those are the constants that come out. So you can always scale them away, but I'm just indulging myself about surface water waves. So that's my last example of the day, surface water waves.
What is J capital?
Sorry?
What is J capital?
J capital is G capital, arbitrary. U squared in a classical case, U cubed in another classical case, arbitrary in arbitrary cases. All of them are Hamiltonian systems. Squared and cubed are especially interesting from integrable point of view, but you can pose a mathematical question for any G. So my example 7 is surface water waves. Maybe more appropriate for next week, or actually, after this talk, I'm sure you're hot, I'm hot, I'm going to go jump in the pond, and then that's appropriate. It's best to draw a drawing. This is water. Well, it's really chalk on a blackboard, but let's think of it as water in a day like this. Here's X. I want to be that an RD minus 1. And Y is going to be an R1. So Y is one vertical dimension, and gravity pulls us down. That's why we're here on Earth. And this is filled with water, but actually there's a free surface. So I want to say the surface. Of course, I'm from California. Water surfaces are not always grass. In fact, that's what makes California California. But let's pretend for the moment that it is. So eta, probably on Lake Ontario, it's more or less true. So eta of X and T is the surface. So let's just say the surface is grass. And here is potential flow. So Laplacian phi equals 0. I have to solve this in that region. And then my velocity field, I'm satisfying Euler's equations, is the gradient of phi. And everyone likes Neumann boundary conditions. Phi satisfies Neumann boundary conditions, which are minus y derivative equals 0 on the bottom boundary. So now, due to Sakharov, you can make a Hamiltonian which will describe this motion. And I'm going to do that as follows. We have eta of x and t, the height of the water, and phi is a potential function whose gradient gives me the velocity in Eulerian and coordinates. So I'm going to call the boundary data of phi, I'm going to call that xi. So phi of x, y equals eta of x, and this can change in time, and time. And that's my xi. And now I have a Hamiltonian, which is integral, 1/2. And I have to say, this is not exactly how Sakharov wrote it, but it is maybe a neat way to do such, maybe the neatest way. A quadratic form involving an operator g of eta. And then the gravity is given by a lower order term, eta squared dx. Integral over x over r d minus 1. Well, actually, I'm going to make this periodic over a period. So I'm going to have this mod a lattice. So I'm going to make this a torus. I have to say what g is, where g is the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. That is, it does the following thing. You're given data on the surface. And then you make a harmonic extension to a harmonic function in the entire fluid domain. So then from the data, you get a phi x and y. But of course, that's ill-defined. But if you do so, it satisfies the bottom boundary condition. It's well-defined. So this is satisfying boundary conditions. So you add this plus boundary conditions, you get a harmonic extension. Now, take the harmonic extension, take its gradient, take it to the surface and dot it with the normal. So that is that y is equal to eta of x. And then do one more thing, which is multiply it by a normalizing thing. 1 plus partial x squared is 1/2. And that defines, so how do you write defines? That defines g of xi. And now, everything, including your domain of definition, depends on the domain, which is defined by eta. So it's clearly an operator which depends on eta, and in a funny and probably nonlinear and non-local way. It's a little bit complicated. But it's pretty clear it's also, you're solving a linear equation, so it's a linear operator on xi. You take that linear operator, you put it in here, and that's a real-valued function. And then all these dynamics, and I haven't even told you what happens on the boundary. Well, the way to describe that, all the physics is by saying partial t eta is equal to the xi variation of h, and partial t xi is equal to minus the eta variation of h. And that gives the evolution of the ocean. Well, in a flat Earth, on a round Earth, you have to modify that slightly. Let me point out one small thing. It's pretty clear that the xi derivative of a quadratic form is easy to calculate. And the eta derivative of the L2 norm is pretty easy to calculate. But there's something which is a little subtle and I find quite beautiful, is you have to also take, and it's involved in this, the eta derivative of the Dirichlet-Neumann operator. So this is a calculation which dates, in fact, to Adamar. It's called the variational formula of Adamar, where you take basically the Dirichlet integral, and for fixed Dirichlet data, you vary the domain. Actually, Adamar took the Green's function for a domain and took the variation of the Green's function with respect to domain. It's a very interesting formula. It's implicated in the water wave problem. Now I'm left with very few minutes, unfortunately, to describe what I wanted to describe to you. So I'm going to say it very rapidly. I won't. I promise I won't. But I'll say a very few words about it. So I now have a phase space, which might be R2n, or a neighborhood in R2n, or it might be a Hilbert manifold. I think for these PDE, just think of a neighborhood in a Hilbert space near zero. And I want to say what an invariant torus is. So it's an n-dimensional invariant torus is a mapping S, C, it maps the torus, which is parameterized by angles C, into the phase space. And what do I want of it? What I want is that not only is it left invariant by the flow, but the flow is parameterized on it in a nice fashion. So I want to say that right. I want to say that I want S to obey the following thing. If I take C, that is, there's a frequency vector omega, such that if I take C on that flow, or C, the lift of C on the torus, and move in the direction omega, and that's the same thing as if I take the flow of the differential of the PDE and for time t at my starting point. And of course, the omega is a frequency. So omega is a point in Rm frequency. And of course, this relation implies that the time derivative of S, which is, of course, going to appear, remember I have a differential equation, a PDE, d by dt of u is equal to j gradient h. So that says d by dt of s has to be equal to, just reading this relationship off, it has to equal two things. It has to equal to omega dot partial xi of s from the left-hand side, and the right-hand side, I mean, reading the equation, it has to be equal to j, the variation of h at that embedding, f. And this is an equation. So let me rewrite it by inverting j. So this isn't my equation 8, because I forgot to label equation 7. So this is the following equation. It's j inverse omega dot partial xi s plus or minus the variation with respect to u of h of s. And this is an equation to solve for s, an embedding, and omega, the frequency vector, which is going to obey this thing. And it's, in general, a small divisor problem. And if we look at the example from spheres, where before I put in the perturbation, I looked at nearby great circles, and they all had the same frequency, it's a problem which involves both small divisors and exact resonances. So the spheres are a case where there are exact resonances. So notice I didn't say my theorem about in spheres, which is still, I don't know, ask our colloquium lecturer. But both are involved. And what I wanted to do was simply rephrase this as a variational problem. And I'm going to do that in my minus 2 minutes. Actually, we started late because there was a dinner space announcement, so I'm going to steal those moments, although it's really a crime on a hot day. So, excuse me, and I will just say how to pose this as a variational problem. And I'm afraid Morse bot theory is out the window. That's for tea. So consider not an individual S, but a space of S, a space of mapping. So S is going to be part of a space of mapping, say capital X. So that's defined to be all mapping SC from my M torus into my phase space. And it has a topology if you're to do analysis, but we haven't the time. So the problem dictates the space. So when you figure out how to do the analysis, you figure out which topology you need. And you define action functionals. So do the following thing. I on a map, and the mapping will have certain smoothness, so this I in a mapping is equal to the following thing. You take half integral over the torus of S J, well, J inverse, dxc J of S. dxc of S, dxc, integrate over the torus. But in fact, there are m many of them. So you take j equals 1 up to m. The jth action is the dxcj. And it's not really, there's no canonical definition of this, just take a basis of the torus. I don't know, what do you do? Take a basis of homology of the torus and then take all independent partial derivatives. And then you notice the following thing, that the variation with respect to u of I of u is equal to j inverse partial cj of u. And that appears here. J inverse partial c of f, that's vectorial, that's a piece. Oh, here's the jth operator, that's a piece of that. So I want to do the following thing. I have actions, and I also want one more thing. I want to define h bar. So I take h of an embedding, and then I integrate it over the m torus, big C. And that's h bar, the average Hamiltonian. And then I am ready for the following. I'm ready for my final statement, which is let M sub A be a subset of X, a constraint space. It's going to be, here's my definition of M. It's all those mappings such that the actions are prescribed. So the first I of that mapping is equal to A1. And the second I of that mapping is equal to A2, et cetera. The mth action is equal to A sub M. So it's a variety which depends on A. And it is, this is, of course, infinite dimensional space of mappings. This is an infinite dimensional space of mappings. Codimension M. And then here's my statement. That is, looking at 8, 8 is equivalent to the following thing. The variation of h bar is equal to omega dot the variation of I. This is already the variation of h. If I turn it into the space of mappings, it's the mapping variation of the space of h bar. And this is the variation of I from my little calculation up above. And my interpretation is, find critical points of H bar on MA. And such, if they exist, if they're not just some weak currents which has some definition as a entropy solution to the Hamilton-Jacobi equation or something, if you actually find a smooth version of such, that's an invariant torus. So all the rest of the story, which will take longer than you want to hear, today at least, is to show how you can find critical points and how you can count them. But I'll stop here.